Plato, The Republic. I went down to Piraeus yesterday with Glaucon, the son of Ariston, to offer a prayer to the goddess. Also, I wanted to watch the festival to see how they would conduct it, since this was the first time it was being celebrated. The parade of Athenians struck me as excellent, and the show put on by the Thracians was every bit as impressive, I thought. We offered our prayers, watched the festival, and then started off on our journey back to town. We were already on our way home when we were spotted by Polymarchus, the son of Cephalus. He got his slave to run after us and tell us to wait for him. The slave tugged at my cloak from behind and said, "Polymarchus says you are to wait." I turned round and asked him where his master was. "There he is," he said, "coming along behind you. Wait for him." "We will," said Glaucon. In a few moments, Polymarchus reached us with Glaucon's brother, Adimantus, Nicaratus, the son of Nicias, and a few others. They had been watching the procession, apparently, and Polymarchus said, "It looks as if you're all on your way back to the city, Socrates. You're not staying, then?" "That's not a bad guess," I replied. "Do you see how many of us there are?" he asked. "Yes." "Well, then," he said, "you must either get the better of all these people, or else stay here." "There is another possibility," I said. "We might persuade you that you should let us go." "And do you really think you could persuade us," he said, "if we refuse to listen?" "Of course not," said Glaucon. "In that case, make your decision on the assumption we're not going to listen." "Haven't you heard about the torch race?" Adimantus added. "This evening on horseback, in honour of the goddess." "On horseback," I said. "That's something new. Do you mean a relay race on horseback, passing torches from one to another?" "Yes," said Polymarchus. "And they're going to have an all-night ceremony as well, which should be worth watching. We can go out and watch it after dinner. There'll be lots of young people there. We can spend some time with them and talk to them. Do stay. Please say yes." "It looks as if we shall have to," said Glaucon. "If that's your decision," I said, "we shall." So we went back to the house of Polymarchus, where we found Polymarchus's brothers, Lysias and Euthydemus, as well as Thrasymachus of Chalcedon, Charmantides from the deme of Paeania, and Clitophon, the son of Aristonymus. Also there in the house was Polymarchus's father, Cephalus. It was a long time since I'd seen him, and I found him much aged. He was wearing a garland and sitting on a sort of cushioned stool. He'd just been conducting a sacrifice in the courtyard. There was a circle of stools around him, so we sat down with him. As soon as he saw me, Cephalus started to make me welcome. "You don't often come down to visit us in Piraeus, Socrates," he said. "You should, though. If I were still strong enough to make the journey up to town without difficulty, there would be no need for you to come here. We would go to you, but as things are, you should come more often. I can assure you, speaking for myself, that the more the pleasures of the body fade, the greater becomes one's desire and taste for conversation. So do, please, spend some time with these young men. Do come here and visit us. Regard us as your friends, as your family, even." "With pleasure, Cephalus," I replied. "I love talking to the very old. It's as if they're a long way ahead of us on a road which we too are probably going to have to travel. I feel we should learn from them what the road is like, whether it's steep and rough going or gentle and easy. In particular, I'd very much like to hear how it strikes you now that you've actually reached the time of life which the poets call old age, the threshold. What is your report on it? Would you call it a difficult time of life?"
"I'll tell you exactly how it strikes me, Socrates. There's a group of us who meet fairly often. We're all about the same age, so we're following the words of the old proverb. When we meet, most of them start complaining. They say they miss the things they used to enjoy when they were young, and they recall their sexual exploits, their drinking, their feasting, and everything connected with those pleasures. They get upset, as if they'd suffered some great loss, as if then they had led a wonderful life, whereas now they're not alive at all. Some of them also complain about the lack of respect shown by their families towards old age, and under this heading they recite a litany of grievances against old age. I think they're putting the blame in the wrong place, Socrates. If old age were to blame, then not only would I have felt the same way about old age, but so would everyone else who has ever reached this age. And yet I've met several people who are not like this. Most notably, Sophocles, the poet. I was there once when someone asked him, "How is your sex life, Sophocles? Are you still capable of making love to a woman?" "Don't talk about it, my good sir," was Sophocles' reply. "It is with the greatest relief that I've escaped it, like escaping from a fierce and frenzied master." I thought that a good reply at the time, and I still think it a good one now. Old age is altogether a time of great peace and freedom from that sort of thing. When our appetites fade and loosen their grip on us, then what happens is exactly what Sophocles was talking about. It is a final release from a bunch of insane masters. Both in this and in your relations with your family, there is only one thing responsible, and that is not old age, but your character. For those who are civilized and contented, then even old age is only a slight burden. Otherwise, for those who are not like this, both old age and youth prove hard to cope with. I was very impressed by what he said, and I wanted him to go on talking, so I prompted him further. "I suspect most people don't believe you, Cephalus, when you say that. They think it is not your character which makes old age easy for you, but the fact that you have plenty of money. The rich, they say, have many consolations. And there's some truth in what they say, but not as much truth as they think." Themistocles' famous saying is very much to the point here. "A man from Seriphos started making disparaging remarks about him, and telling him that his fame was due not to his own merits, but to those of his city. Themistocles' reply was that though he himself would never have been famous if he had been born in Seriphos, neither would the other man have been if he had been born in Athens. The same applies to those who are not rich, and who find old age hard to bear. In poverty, even the right temperament will not find old age altogether easy, whereas the wrong temperament, even with the aid of wealth, will never be at peace with itself. What would you say is the greatest benefit you have derived from your possession of great wealth?" I said. "One which many people might not be inclined to believe if I told them, but you can take my word for it, Socrates, that when you are confronted by the thought of your own death, you are visited by fear and anxiety about things which never troubled you before. The stories told about what happens in Hades, that anyone who is unjust here will have to pay for it there, stories you once laughed at, begin to trouble your mind. That's why I attach the greatest importance to the possession of money, not for everyone, but for those of good character. If you want to avoid defrauding people or lying to them, however reluctantly, or going to the world below in a state of terror after failing to pay what you owe, whether sacrifices to a god or money to a man, then the possession of money contributes in no small measure to this end." "That's admirably put, Cephalus," I said. "But since you've brought up the subject of justice, can we say, quite simply, that it is truthfulness and returning anything you may have received from anyone else? Or is it sometimes right to behave in these ways and sometimes wrong? Let me give you an example. Suppose you borrowed some weapons from a friend when he was in his right mind. Suppose he later went mad and then asked for them back again. Everyone would agree, I imagine, that you shouldn't give them back to him, and that anyone who did give them back, or who was even prepared to be completely truthful to someone in this condition, would not be doing the right thing." "Correct," he said. "This is not the definition of justice, then, that it is telling the truth and returning what you have been given." "Yes, it is, Socrates," Polymarchus interrupted. "At least, it is if we are to believe Simonides." "I'd just like to say," Cephalus put in, "that this is where I hand the discussion over to you. It's time I was doing something about the sacrifices. Well, am I not Polymarchus, your heir? You certainly are, he replied with a laugh, and went off to his sacrifices. Tell me then, I said, you who have inherited the argument, what does Simonides say about justice that you think is correct? That it is just to pay everyone what is owed to him. That's what he says, and I think he's right. Well, I said, Simonides is a wise and inspired man. It is certainly not easy to disagree with him. But what on earth does he mean by this remark? You may well know, Polymarchus. I have no idea. He obviously doesn't mean what we were talking about just now. If one person gives something to another for safekeeping and then asks for it back when he's not in his right mind, Simonides doesn't mean that the other person should give it to him. And yet I imagine the thing which was given for safekeeping is owed to the person who gave it, isn't it? Yes. In that situation, when someone goes out of his mind and then asks for it back, isn't returning it completely out of the question? Yes, it is. That isn't what Simonides means, apparently, when he says that it is just to pay back what is owed or due. No, it certainly isn't, he said. What he thinks is due to friends is to do them good, not harm. I understand, I replied. If one person gives back to another money which the other has given him for safekeeping, he is not giving what is due if he is returning it and the others receiving it are harmful, and if the two of them are friends. Isn't that what you think Simonides means? Yes, it is. What about enemies? Should you give them whatever is in fact due to them? You certainly should, he said, and what is due between enemies is what is appropriate, something harmful. Simonides was speaking as a poet then, apparently, and disguising his definition of justice. What he meant, it seems, was that justice was giving any individual what was appropriate for him. But he called it what was owed. Yes, that must have been what he meant. Suppose, then, one of us had said to him, Simonides, take the art or skill which is called medicine. What does it give that is due and appropriate, and to what does it give it? What do you think his answer would have been? Obviously, he replied, he would have said it gives the body drugs and food and drink. And the art of cookery, what does it give that is due and appropriate, and to what does it give it? It gives flavour to cooked food. Very well. Then what about the art or skill which we would call justice? What does it give, and to what does it give it? Well, if we're to follow the previous definition, Socrates, it gives benefits and injuries to friends and enemies. Does he mean, then, that helping your friends and harming your enemies is justice? I think so. All right. When people are unwell, when it's a question of sickness and health, who is best at helping them if they are friends and harming them if they are enemies? A doctor. And when they're at sea, who can best help or harm them amid the dangers of a sea voyage? A ship's captain. What about the just man? In what activity and for what purpose is he the one best able to treat his friends well and his enemies badly? In war and alliances, I think. Very well. Now, when people aren't ill, my dear Polymarchus, a doctor is no use to them. True. And when they're not at sea, a ship's captain is no use to them. No. Does that mean the just man is no use to them when they're not at war? No, I'm sure it doesn't. Justice is something useful, even in peacetime, then? Yes, it is. But then so is agriculture, isn't it? Yes, for producing crops. Yes, and shoemaking? Yes, that's useful. For producing shoes, you would say, presumably. Of course. What about justice, then? When you say it's useful in peacetime, what is it useful for? What does it produce? Contracts, Socrates. And by contracts, do you mean partnerships or something else? I mean, partnerships. All right.
Is the just man a good and useful partner when it comes to playing backgammon? Or would someone who plays backgammon be more use? Someone who plays backgammon would be more use. And when it comes to bricklaying or building in stone, is the just man a more useful and better partner than a builder? Of course not. Well, in what kind of partnership is the just man a better partner than a lyre player, in the way a lyre player is better at playing the notes? In partnerships involving money, I think. Unless by any chance, Polymarchus, it's a question of putting the money to some use, if you have to buy or sell a horse jointly for a sum of money. In that case, I imagine, someone who knows about horses is more use, isn't he? Apparently. And for buying or selling a ship, you'd want a shipbuilder or ship's captain. So it seems. In what situation, then, requiring the joint use of silver or gold, is the just man more useful than anyone else? When there's a need to deposit money and have it kept safe? You mean when there's no need to put it to any use? You just want it to stay where it is? That's right. So it's when money is useless that justice is useful for dealing with it. It looks like it. And a pruning knife. When you want to keep it safe, then justice is useful, both in public life and in private life. But when you want to use it, then the art of viticulture is what you want. Apparently. And are you going to say the same about a shield or a lyre? That justice is useful when you need to keep them safe and not use them, but that when you do need to use them, then you want the soldier's art and the art of music? I shall have to say that. And in all other examples, justice is useless when it comes to using any of them, and useful only when they are useless? I suppose so, he said. Though personally, I can't any longer remember what I did say. But one thing I do think still, and that is that justice is treating your friends well and your enemies badly. By friends, do you mean the people each individual believes to be good, or those who really are good, even if he doesn't realise it? And the same with enemies. In all probability, he replied, people will like those they think are good and dislike those they think are evil. And do people ever make mistakes in this? Do they often think people are good when they're not, and vice versa? Yes, they do make mistakes. So for these people, are the good their enemies, and the bad their friends? They certainly are. Is it nonetheless right for these people, when this happens, to treat the wicked well and the good badly? It looks like it. And the good are just. They're not the kind of people who do wrong. True. So, according to your argument, it is right to harm those who do no wrong. Impossible, Socrates. It looks as if there's something wrong with the argument. Then it must be right, I said, to treat the unjust badly and the just well. That sounds better. In that case, Polymarchus, there are many people for whom it'll turn out, if their judgment of people has been at fault, that it is right to treat their friends badly, since their friends are evil, and their enemies well, since their enemies are good. In those circumstances, we shall end up saying the exact opposite of the definition we quoted from Simonides. Yes, he said, it certainly can turn out like that. Let's change our definition. We're probably not defining friend and enemy correctly. How are we defining them, Polymarchus? We said that the person who seemed to be good was a friend. And now, how do you want to change that definition? If someone both seems to be good and is, let's call him a friend. If he seems to be, but isn't really, let's say that he seems to be a friend, but isn't really a friend. And let the same definition apply to an enemy. On this definition, it appears the good man will be a friend, and the one who is no good will be an enemy. Yes.
Do you want us to make an addition to our definition of justice? Our first definition was that it was just to help a friend and harm an enemy. Do you want us now to add to that and say that it is just to help a friend if he is good and harm an enemy if he is bad? Yes, he said, I think that would be an excellent definition. But is it really in the nature of a just man, I asked, to treat anyone in the world badly? It certainly is, he said. He should treat badly those who are wicked, his enemies. If you treat a horse badly, does it become better or worse? Worse. Worse by the standard we use to judge dogs or the standard we use to judge horses? The standard we use to judge horses. And dogs the same. If you treat them badly, they become worse by the standard we use to judge dogs, not horses. They must do. What about humans, my friend? Are we to say in the same way that if they are treated badly, they become worse by the standard we use to judge human excellence? Certainly. But isn't justice a form of human excellence? Again, it must be. In which case, my friend, members of the human race who are treated badly must necessarily become more unjust. It looks like it. Are musicians able, by means of music, to make people unmusical? No, that's impossible. Can horsemen make people unskilled with horses by means of horsemanship? No. And can the just make people unjust by means of justice? Or, in general, can the good use human excellence to make people bad? No, that's impossible. Yes, because it's not the property of heat, I assume, to make things cold. It's the property of its opposite. Yes, nor is it the property of dryness to make things wet, but of its opposite. Yes, and it is certainly not the property of good to do harm or treat people badly, but of its opposite. Apparently. And the just man is good? Yes. In that case, Polymarchus, it is not the property of the just man to treat his friend or anyone else badly. It is the property of his opposite, the unjust man. Even in the middle of our conversation, Thrasymachus had repeatedly tried to take control of the discussion. But each time he had been prevented by those sitting round us, who wanted to hear the discussion through to the end. But when we reached this stopping place in the argument, he was incapable of remaining silent any longer. He gathered himself and sprang at us like a wild beast at its prey. Speaking up loud and clear, Thrasymachus said, "What's this nonsense that has got into you too, Socrates? Why be so obliging? Why keep giving way to one another? If you really want to know what justice is, then stop simply asking questions and scoring points by proving that any answer given by anyone else is wrong. You know perfectly well it's easier to ask questions than to give answers. Come on, why don't you give some answers yourself? Tell us what you say justice is, and don't go telling us that it's what's necessary, or what's beneficial, or what's advantageous, or what's profitable, or what's good for you. I won't take any of that stuff. No. Tell us, please, quite clearly exactly what you mean." "Don't be angry with us, Thrasymachus," I said, with some apprehension. "If Polymarchus and I are making mistakes in our examination of the arguments, I assure you, we're not making them on purpose. If we're looking for gold, we wouldn't deliberately give way to one another in our search and so destroy our chances of finding it. So, since what we are actually looking for is justice, a thing more valuable than a large quantity of gold, you can't imagine we are so stupid as to make concessions to one another and not be determined to bring it as clearly as possible into view. Believe us, my friend. The trouble is, we lack the ability. So when you clever people see our efforts, pity is really a far more appropriate reaction than annoyance. This brought an unpleasant laugh from Thrasymachus. Oh, my God, he said, I knew it, the famous modesty of Socrates. I predicted it. I told these people you'd refuse to give any answers, that you'd pretend to be modest, that you'd do anything to avoid answering if anyone asked you a question.
Clever of you, Thrasymachus. Clever enough to know what would happen if you were to ask someone what 12 was, but then give him a warning before he answered, Now look here, don't go telling us that 12 is twice 6, or 3 times 4, or 6 times 2, or 4 times 3. I'm not going to take any nonsense of that sort from you. It was obvious to you, I imagine, that if you asked the question in that way, no one could possibly answer it.
Is that just what you're going to do now? Are you going to give one of the answers I told you not to give?
It wouldn't surprise me, I said, if on reflection I came to that conclusion.
What if I give you an answer about justice which is quite different from all those other answers, a much better answer than those? What do you think should be your penalty?
Well, obviously, the penalty appropriate to someone who doesn't know. He should learn, I take it, from the person who does know.
You innocent, said Thrasymachus. No, you must do more than learn. You must pay me some money as well.
Very well. As soon as I have any, I will.
You do have some, said Glaucon. If it's money you're worried about, Thrasymachus, go ahead and speak. We will all pay up for Socrates.
I'll bet you will, he said. Anything to allow Socrates to play his usual trick, not answer the question himself, but wait for someone else to answer it, and then take what he says and try to prove it wrong.
Really, my dear fellow, I said. How could anyone answer the question if, for a start, he didn't know the answer, didn't so much as claim to know it? And on top of that, even supposing he did have some idea on the subject, if he'd been told by a man of some authority not to say any of the things he thought. No, it makes much more sense for you to speak. You're the one who claims to know the answer and have something to say. So please, as a favour to me, don't keep your answer to yourself. Give Glaucon here and the others the benefit of your knowledge.
Hear it, then, he said. I say that justice is simply what is good for the stronger.
Well, where's all that praise? You're not going to give it, are you?
Yes, I will, as soon as I understand what you mean. At the moment, I still don't know. What is good for the stronger, you say, is just. What do you mean by that, Thrasymachus? If Polydamas, the all-in wrestler, is stronger than us, and eating beef is good for building his body, you presumably don't mean that this food is also good, and right, for us, who are weaker than him.
Socrates, you're beneath contempt. You're taking what I said in the way which makes it easiest to misrepresent my meaning.
Not at all, my friend, but you'll have to tell me more clearly what you mean.
All right, he said. You must be aware that some cities are tyrannies, some are democracies, and others aristocracies.
Of course.
And what is in control in each city is the ruling power.
Yes.
Every ruling power makes laws for its own good. A democracy makes democratic laws, a tyranny, tyrannical laws, and so on. In making these laws, they make it clear that what is good for them, the rulers, is what is just for their subjects. If anyone disobeys, they punish him for breaking the law and acting unjustly. That's what I mean, my friend, when I say that in all cities the same thing is just, namely, what is good for the ruling authority. This, I take it, is where the power lies, and the result is, for anyone who looks at it in the right way, that the same thing is just everywhere, what is good for the stronger.
Now I understand what you mean, I said, though whether or not it is true remains to be seen. So even your answer, Thrasymachus, is that what is good for a person is just, though that was an answer you told me firmly not to give. But you add the qualification, for the stronger.
A trivial addition, you may say.
That's not yet clear. It may well be an important one. What is clear is that we must examine whether what you say is true.
Like you, I agree that justice is something that is good for a person. But while you qualify it as what is good for the stronger, I'm not so sure. We should examine the question.
Go on, then. Examine it.
I shall, I said. Tell me, don't you also say that it is right for subjects to obey their rulers?
I do.
And are they infallible, the rulers in all these cities? Or are they capable of making mistakes?
Well, they are certainly, I imagine, capable of making mistakes.
So, when they set about enacting laws, do they enact some correctly, but a certain number incorrectly?
In my opinion, yes.
And correctly is enacting laws which are in their own interest, and incorrectly is enacting laws which are against their own interest. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
But whatever they enact, their subjects must carry it out. And this is justice.
Of course.
In that case, according to your definition, it is not only just to do what is good for the stronger, but also its opposite, what is not good for him.
What do you mean? He said.
I mean what you mean, I think. Let's look at it more closely. Haven't we agreed that the rulers, in giving orders to their subjects to do anything, sometimes make mistakes about what is in their own best interest, but that it is just for the subjects to carry out whatever orders their rulers give them? Isn't that what we have agreed?
Yes, he said, I accept that.
Then you must also accept, I said, that we have agreed it is just to do things which are not good for the rulers and the stronger, when the rulers inadvertently issue orders which are harmful to themselves, and you say it is just for their subjects to carry out the orders of their rulers. In that situation, most wise Thrasymachus, isn't the inevitable result that it is just to do the exact opposite of what you say? After all, the weaker have been ordered to do what is not good for the stronger.
Indeed they have, Socrates, said Polymarchus. No question about it.
No question at all, Cleitophon interrupted, if you're acting as a witness for Socrates.
Who needs a witness? Said Polymarchus.
Thrasymachus himself agrees that rulers sometimes issue orders which are bad for themselves, but that it is right for their subjects to carry out these orders.
Yes, Polymarchus, because carrying out orders issued by rulers was what Thrasymachus defined as just.
Yes, Cleitophon, but in his definition he also said that what was good for the stronger was just. He gave both those definitions, and then went on to agree that those who are stronger sometimes tell those who are weaker, their subjects, to do what is bad for them, the stronger. It follows from these admissions that what is good for those who are stronger would be no more just than what is not good for them.
When he talked about what was good for the stronger, said Cleitophon, he meant what the stronger thought was good for him. This is what the weaker must do, and that was his definition of justice.
Those weren't the words he used, said Polymarchus.
It's neither here nor there, Polymarchus, I said. If those are the words Thrasymachus is using now, let's take it in that sense.
Tell me, Thrasymachus, was that how you wanted to define justice, as what the stronger thinks is good for him, whether it really is good or not? Is that what we should take you to be saying?
Certainly not, he said. Do you imagine I regard a person who makes a mistake at the moment when he is making the mistake as stronger?
That's certainly what I thought you meant when you agreed that rulers are not infallible, that they sometimes make mistakes.
You're always trying to trick people, Socrates, in the way you argue. I mean, if someone makes a mistake in treating the sick, do you call him a doctor by virtue of the actual mistake? Or an accountant who makes a mistake at the precise moment when he is making his mistake by virtue of this mistake?
No, I think that's just the form of words we use. We say, the doctor made a mistake, the accountant made a mistake, the teacher made a mistake.
But the reality, I think, is that none of them, to the extent that he is what we call him, ever makes a mistake. In precise language, since you like speaking precisely, no one who exercises a skill ever makes a mistake. So the ruler, to the extent that he is a ruler,
does not make mistakes, and since he does not make mistakes, he does enact what is best for him, and this is what his subject must carry out. So, as I said originally, my definition is that it is just to do what is good for the stronger.
Very well, Thrasymachus, I said. So you think I'm a trickster, do you?
I certainly do.
You think I've been asking the questions I have been asking with the deliberate intention of winning the argument unfairly?
I'm quite sure of it. It won't do you any good, though. You can't use unfair arguments without my noticing, and once I notice what you're up to, you don't have the resources to defeat me in open argument.
As if I'd even dream of trying. But since we don't want this situation to arise again, could you make one thing clear? When you say it is right for the weaker to do what is good for the stronger, do you mean the ruler and the stronger in normal usage, or in the precise sense you were talking about just now?
I mean the ruler in the most precise sense possible.
Tell me then, you were talking just now about the doctor in the precise sense. Is he a businessman or a healer of the sick? And make sure it's the true doctor you're talking about.
He's a healer of the sick.
What about a ship's captain? Is a ship's captain, in the correct sense, a master of sailors or a sailor?
A master of sailors.
It's not an objection, I take it, that he sails in the ship. Nor is he for that reason to be called a sailor, since the title, ship's captain, does not depend on his sailing, but on his art or skill and his authority over the sailors.
True,
he said. And for each of these, is there something which is good for him?
Yes.
Doesn't the art or skill come into existence for just this reason, to seek out and provide what is good for each person?
Yes, it does.
For each of these skills, then, is there anything else which is good for it, apart from being as perfect as possible?
I don't understand your question.
Suppose you asked me if it was enough for the body to be the body, or whether it needed something else. I would reply, it certainly does need something else. That's the reason why the art of medicine has come to be invented, because the body is defective and, therefore, not self-sufficient. So the art of medicine was developed to provide it with the things which were good for it. Do you think I'd be right in giving that answer, or not?
Yes, I think you'd be right.
What about medicine itself? Is that defective? Does any art or skill, for that matter, stand in need of some virtue or excellence, in the way that eyes need sight and ears need hearing, and sight and hearing require an art or skill to preside over them, an art or skill which will think about and provide what is good for them? Is there any defect in the actual art or skill itself? Isn't the art or skill itself, in the precise sense, without fault or blemish, if it is correct, so long as it is entirely what it is? And when you answer, use words in the precise sense you were talking about. Is it as I have described, or not?
It is as you have described, he said, apparently.
In that case, I said, the art of medicine does not think about what is good for the art of medicine, but what is good for the body.
Yes.
And horsemanship does not think about what is good for horsemanship, but what is good for horses. Nor does any art or skill think about what is good for itself. It has no need to. No, it thinks about what is good for the thing of which it is the art or skill.
Apparently.
But surely, Thrasymachus, arts and skills control and have power over the objects of which they are the arts and skills. He conceded this, though with great reluctance. In which case, there's no branch or knowledge which thinks about or prescribes what is good for the stronger, but only what is good for the weaker, for what is under its control. He agreed to this too, in the end, though he tried to resist it. And when he did agree, I continued,
Isn't it a fact that no doctor, to the extent that he is a doctor, thinks about or prescribes what is good for the doctor? No. He thinks about what is good for the patient. After all, it was agreed that a doctor, in the precise sense, is responsible for bodies. He's not a businessman. Isn't that what was agreed? Thrasymachus assented. And that the ship's captain, in the precise sense, was in command of sailors, not a sailor. Yes, that was agreed. So a ship's captain or commander of this type will not think about or prescribe what is good for the ship's captain, but what is good for the sailor, for the person under his command. He agreed, though reluctantly. And so, Thrasymachus, I said, no one in any position of authority, to the extent that he is in authority, thinks about or prescribes what is good for himself, but only what is good for the person or thing under his authority, for whose benefit he himself exercises his art or skill. Everything he says and everything he does is said or done with this person or thing in mind, with a view to what is good and appropriate for the person or thing under his authority. With these words, I thought I had finished what I had to say, but I was wrong. Apparently, it was only an introduction. Glaucon is an extremely determined character in everything he does, and on this occasion he refused to accept Thrasymachus's surrender. "Socrates," he said, "do you really want to convince us that it is in every way better to be just than unjust, or is it enough merely to seem to have convinced us?" "I would prefer," I said, "really to convince you, if I had a choice." "In that case," he said, "you are not achieving your aim. Tell me this. Do you think there is a good of the kind we would choose to have because we value it for its own sake, and not from any desire for its results? Enjoyment, for example, and pleasures which are harmless and produce no consequences for the future beyond enjoyment for the person who possesses them." "Yes," I said, "I do think there is a good of this kind." "What about the sort we value both for itself and for its consequences, things like intelligence and sight and health? We value goods of this sort, I imagine, for both reasons." "Yes," I said. "And can you distinguish a third class or category of good," he asked, "a class which contains physical exercise, undergoing medical treatment when we are ill, practising medicine, and earning a living in general? These we would describe as unpleasant but beneficial. We would not choose to have them for their own sakes, but only for the payment or other benefits which result from them." "Yes," I said, "there is this third class as well." "What of it?" "In which of these classes," he asked, "do you put justice?" "In my opinion," I replied, "it is in the best class, the class which is to be valued by anyone who wants to be happy, both for itself and for its consequences." "That's not what most people think," he said. "Most people would put it in the unpleasant class, which we should cultivate in return for payment and reputation on account of public opinion, but which purely for itself is to be avoided like the plague." "I know that's what they think," I said. "Thrasymachus criticised it and praised injustice on those grounds some while back. But I'm a slow learner, apparently." "Well," he said, "listen to me as well and see if you agree with what I suggest. I think Thrasymachus too readily allowed himself to be bewitched by you, like a snake being charmed by a snake charmer. As far as I'm concerned, the proof is not yet convincing, either for justice or injustice. I want to be told what each of them is, and what effect it has just by itself,
when it is present in the soul. I want to forget about the rewards and results it brings. So here's what I'm going to do, if you've no objection. I'm going to revive Thrasymachus's definition. First, I shall say what kind of thing people reckon justice is and how they think it arises. Secondly, I shall claim that all those who practice it do so as something unavoidable, against their will, and not because they regard it as a good. Thirdly, I shall say that this is a rational way for them to behave, since the unjust man, in their view, has a much better life than the just man. These are not my own opinions, Socrates, but I'm going to make the most powerful speech I can in defence of the unjust life, and I want to hear you, in your turn, criticising injustice and defending justice. There you are. See if you approve of my suggestion.
I'd like nothing better, I replied.
That's good, he said. Now, listen to the first thing I said I was going to talk about. What sort of thing justice is, and how it arises. Doing wrong, men say, is by its nature a good, and being wronged an evil. But the evil of being wronged outweighs the good of doing wrong. As a result, when people wrong one another and are wronged by one another and get a taste of both, those who are unable to avoid the one and achieve the other think it'll pay them to come to an agreement with one another not to do wrong and not to be wronged. That's how they come to start making laws and agreements with one another and calling lawful and just that which is laid down by the law. They say that justice is a compromise between the best case, which is doing wrong and getting away with it, and the worst case, which is being wronged and being unable to retaliate. The easiest way to see that it is true is to imagine something like this. Suppose we gave each of them, the just and the unjust, the freedom to do whatever he liked. Suppose they had the kind of power they say the ancestor of Gyges the Lydian once had. They say he was a shepherd, and that he was a serf of the man who was at that time the ruler of Lydia. One day there was a great rainstorm and an earthquake in the place where he grazed his sheep. Part of the ground opened up, and a great hole appeared in it. He was astonished when he saw it, but went down into it. And the legend has it that among many marvels he saw a hollow horse made of bronze, with windows in it. Peeping through them, he saw inside what appeared to be a corpse, larger than human, wearing nothing but a golden ring on its hand. They say he removed the ring and came out. The shepherds were having one of their regular meetings so that they could give the king their monthly report on the flocks, and the man turned up as well, wearing the ring. As he sat with the rest of them, he happened to twist the setting of the ring towards him into the palm of his hand. When he did this, he became invisible to those who were sitting with him, and they started talking about him as if he'd gone. He was amazed and twisted the ring again, turning the setting to the outside. As soon as he did so, he became visible. When he realised this, he started experimenting with the ring to see if it did have this power, and he found that that was how it was. When he turned the setting to the inside, he became invisible. When he turned it to the outside, he became visible. Once he had established this, he lost no time arranging to be one of those making the report to the king. When he got there, he seduced the king's wife, plotted with her against the king, killed him, and seized power. Imagine there were two rings like that, and the just man wore one, while the unjust man wore the other. People think that no one would be sufficiently iron-willed to remain within the bounds of justice. No one could bring himself to keep his hands off other people's possessions and steer clear of them if he was free to take whatever he liked without a second thought, in the marketplace or go into people's houses and sleep with anyone he liked, or if he could kill or release from prison anyone he chose, and in general go round acting like a god among men. This is a strong argument, you might say, for the claim that no one is just voluntarily, but only under compulsion. Justice is not thought to be a good thing for individuals, since wherever anyone thinks he can do wrong, he does do wrong. Every man believes injustice to be much more profitable for the individual than justice, and he will be right to think this, according to the person putting forward this view. Anyone who came into possession of the kind of freedom I have described, and then refused ever to do anything wrong, and did not lay a finger on other people's possessions, would be regarded by observers as the most pathetic and brainless of creatures, though, of course, in public they would praise him, lying to one another because of their fear of being wronged. That's all I have to say about that claim. As for the choice between the lives of the people in question, the only way we can make it properly is by contrasting the completely just man with the completely unjust man. How shall we contrast them? Like this. We will subtract nothing either from the injustice of the unjust man or from the justice of the just man. Let's assume, if the unjust man is going to be really unjust, that he goes about his wrongdoings in the right way and gets away with it. The one who gets caught is to be regarded as incompetent, since perfect injustice consists in appearing to be just when you are not. We must credit the completely unjust man, then, with the most complete injustice. To the person who commits the greatest wrongs, we must not deny, in fact we must grant, the enjoyment of the greatest reputation for justice. That is our model of the unjust man. Beside him, let us put our imaginary just man, a simple and honourable man who wants, in Aeschylus's words, not to appear to be good, but to be good. We must deprive him of the appearance, since if he appears to be just, the appearance of justice will bring him recognition and rewards, and then it will not be clear whether his motive for being just was a desire for justice or a desire for the rewards and the recognition. So we must strip him of everything but justice. We must put him in a situation which is the opposite of our previous example. Despite doing nothing wrong, he must have the worst possible reputation for injustice. Let him live out his life like this, without any change until the day of his death, appearing to be unjust, though actually being just. And if both their situations are as I have described, it shouldn't be beyond us, I imagine, to give a full account of the kind of life which awaits each of them. So that is what I must do now. What Aeschylus said turns out to be a much more accurate description of the unjust man, who wants not to appear to be unjust, but to be unjust. In the first place, they will say, he can be a ruler in his city because of his reputation for justice. Secondly, he can marry where he likes, give his daughters in marriage to whom he chooses, and make contracts and partnerships with anyone he wishes. Besides all this, he finds it easy to make himself a rich man, since he has no compunction about acting unjustly. That is why, they say, he is successful in political and legal disputes, both public and private, and why he gets the better of his enemies. By getting the better of them, he grows rich and can help his friends and harm his enemies. He can make full and generous sacrifices and offerings to the gods, and is much better able than the just man to serve the gods and that part of mankind whom he chooses to serve. As a result, they claim, he is in all probability more likely than the just man to be the god's favourite.
Well, I said, that was certainly an inspired performance. To be able to speak like that in favour of injustice, without being convinced it is a better thing than justice, and I believe you when you say you are really not convinced, though from what you actually said I wouldn't have believed you. The trouble is, the more firmly I believe you, the less certain I am what to do next. I can't defend justice. I don't think I have the ability. I say that because you have rejected the arguments by which I thought I had proved to Thrasymachus that justice was something better than injustice. On the other hand, I can't not defend her, since I can't help feeling it is wrong to stand idly by when I hear justice coming under attack, and not come to her defence for as long as I have breath in my body and a tongue in my head. Well, Glaucon and the rest of them insisted that they wanted me to make a defence and not abandon the argument. So I adopted what seemed to me the best approach. The inquiry we are undertaking is not a simple matter. If you ask me, it requires sharp eyesight, and since we are not clever people, I think we should conduct our search in the same sort of way as we would if our eyesight were not very good, and we were told to read some small writing from a bit of a distance away. And then one of us realised that a larger copy of the same writing, apparently, was to be found somewhere else, on some larger surface. We would regard it as a stroke of luck, I think, to be able to read the large letters first and then turn our attention to the small ones to see if they really did say the same thing. We certainly would, said Adamantus, but where can you see anything like that in our search for justice? I'll tell you, I said. We say that there is justice in an individual, but also, I take it, justice in a whole city? Yes. And a city is something bigger than an individual? Yes, it is. In that case, maybe justice will be on a larger scale in what is larger and easier to find out about. So, if you approve, why don't we start by finding out what sort of thing it is in cities? After that, we can make a similar inquiry into the individual, trying to find the likeness of the larger version in the form the smaller takes. I think that's a good idea, he said. Suppose then, I said, we were to study the theoretical origin of a city. Would we also see the origin in it of justice and injustice? We might, he said. And if we do that, is there a chance that what we are looking for will be easier to find? Yes, much easier. You think, then, that this is a task we should attempt to complete? I suspect it is a fairly major undertaking. So you decide. We have decided, said Adamantus. Go ahead. Very well, I said. The origin of a city lies, I think, in the fact that we are not, any of us, self-sufficient. We have all sorts of needs. Can you think of any other reason for the foundation of a city? No, I can't. In this way, then, different individuals may form associations with one person to meet one need, and with another person to meet a different need. With this variety of wants, they may collect a number of partners and allies into one place of habitation, and to this joint habitation we give the name city, don't we? Yes, we do. Does one person share with another when he does share, or does he accept a share, because he thinks it is better for him personally? Yes, he does. Right then, I said. Let's construct a hypothetical city from the beginning. It is the product, apparently, of our needs. Of course. And the first and most important of those needs, if we are to exist and stay alive, is the provision of food. Unquestionably. Second comes the need for housing. And third, the need for clothing and things like that. That is right. Well then, I said, how will our city be equal to meeting these requirements? Won't it just be one farmer, plus a builder, plus a weaver? Or should we add a shoemaker as well, and anyone else who provides for physical needs? Yes, we should. So the most basic city would have to consist of 4 or 5 men. It looks like it. Well then, will a single individual do better exercising a number of skills, or will each do best concentrating on one? Concentrating on one, he replied. And another thing. It is clear, I think, that if you let the right moment for a task pass by, the task suffers. Yes, that is clear. That is because the task in hand will not wait for the person doing it to have a spare moment. So it is essential that whoever is doing it should concentrate on it and not regard it as a hobby. Yes, it is essential. It follows from this that in any enterprise more is produced, and that it is better and more easily produced, when one person does a single task which is suited to his nature, and does it at the right time, keeping himself free from other tasks. It certainly does. Then it will take more than 4 citizens, Adamantus, to provide for the needs we were talking about. The farmer, it appears, will not make himself a plough with his own hands, not if it's going to be a good plough, nor a hoe, nor any of his other farming implements. No more will the builder, who also needs a number of tools, and the same goes for the weaver and the